David Corren, what is going on, my friend? I appreciate you doing this.
Oh, I'm happy to do it. I'm sorry it's taken so long, but I'm glad we could finally connect. And you had Eric Larson's endorsement, which is the highest endorsement anyone could ever get from my standpoint. So I'm happy to do it. Happy to
That
do it.
makes me very happy. It's funny, I said this is like online dating. I've been writing to you for like 2 years now. I finally broke you down and you decided to come on. And it's funny, I emailed Eric and I'm like, Eric, I'm having David Grant on. I dropped your name and the pictures of us. And then he sent a nice email, but he was upset with you. He wanted us to do this live so he can come to Legends Bar and have some free Manhattans.
I
That's what
know, that's what he
he
said. He wanted a Manhattan.
Next time we'll do that.
You got it. You got it.
Have you ever seen anyone reading your book in public?
That is a really good question. I think I probably have, but it's a very uncomfortable feeling. I'm terrified to actually know what they think. I have a friend, I'll leave it vague, a very good friend, actually a relative who is a writer, who once saw this happening. I don't know if it was on a plane or on a subway, and went up to the person and said, "Oh, what do you think of the book?" And they said, "Oh, it's the worst thing ever."
No, really?
Yes, I'm terrified to ever know what anybody thinks. I just, the good thing about being an author is you have this relationship with the public, but you can be completely shy and removed from that stuff.
What was the cooler moment, being an answer on Jeopardy or being on President Obama's 2003 favorite book list? What was a cooler moment for you?
They're both pretty cool. I don't know. It's funny because I'm a little out of it and I'm so busy doing research. So it's funny because it's your friends who see these different things and you could tell what is more meaningful to them. My kids, I will say, thought it was very cool that Obama had cited my book. So and anytime your kids think you're cool, then that's cool with me.
Then
But
you're winning.
I do have some people who are like Jeopardy obsesses, and so they were more into that.
Born and raised in New York, right?
Born in New York, raised in Connecticut.
Where were your favorite hangouts? Coming into the city a lot? Were you a New York City kid hanging out or not really?
Not really. I was actually pretty much a suburban kid. Then I moved to the city when I met my wife, and I lived in the city, and I lived downtown. And then we lived in Brooklyn. I love Brooklyn. And then I joke, we were finally priced out of Brooklyn. My mother-in-law, who grew up in Brooklyn, said, "I spent my whole life trying to get out of Brooklyn, and now all you kids, all you do is get into Brooklyn."
What part of Brooklyn?
We lived in Carroll Gardens, which was
Oh, nice,
beautiful. Oh,
beautiful,
I loved it.
gorgeous.
And the best Italian food you could ever get. Yeah.
Gorgeous. Now, I know you're a Knicks fan, but you went to school in Connecticut. Connecticut's like the border. You can be Yankee Red Sox, Giants, Patriots. You stayed loyal to the Knicks, thank God, over the Celtics. Any other sports teams you're into?
Yeah, it's a really good point. That dividing line tends to be kind of like behave. If you're like Hartford, you're Patriots,
Yes, yes.
and no, I am a complete diehard New York sports fan, diehard Knicks fan my whole life, diehard Mets fan my whole life, and a Giants fan.
When, because your name's so heavy now, I know you're going to downplay it because you're a very humble guy. Have you ever sat courtside yet for the Knicks, though?
No, but if you can get them to invite me, I'll be really, really happy. I mean, those are the best tickets in the world. I see all the celebrities there, and you see them up on the, you get to see them up on the jumbo thing, and
Yes.
yeah, no, never, never, never. But if you're out there, Dolan, and you want a nerdy scribe, to kind of lower your celebrity stratosphere, I am here. I'm available. I'm willing to go anytime.
So here's the issue. I have on a lot of authors, a lot of athletes, but the authors I have on, it's right after I finish their book. So usually I'll finish a book, have them on. The issue is I crushed 3 of your books through the last couple of years. So now you have to give me an hour for each of your books. So for the next 3 hours, we'll have some fun. David, was it always writer or bust for you? Was that your thing?
That's a really good question. I always had an urge to be a writer, but that's such a strange thing, because what does that even mean? So when you're young, I used to scroll in journals and I wrote some bad poetry. And then when I was in college, I wrote essays and I did some reporting and I wrote some fiction. And then I wrote, when I graduated, an incredibly bad novel that, sits up in an attic that nobody's even read, not even my wife or kids. And so you don't, it's funny. I will say, I don't know if it was bust, but the urge was always there. But how do you channel that? How do you make a living doing that? And it was funny because my mom was in the publishing world. She was an editor, and she was a kind of path-breaking figure as a woman. She was the first female major editor-in-chief of a major New York publishing house. And her only advice to me is that, because I think she knew I had a fragile psyche, and I think she just thought, it's a hard world to be a writer. And her one piece of advice to me is, whatever you do, don't become a writer. So of course I, like any good, she should have learned, from Freud, that, if you tell someone not to do it, that's exactly what they'll do. So I proved her wrong, and I had a very funny story. This is a true story where, I struggled as a writer. I struggled. She was like, be a lawyer, get a job, do something. And then I finally finished Killers of the Flower Moon, and she read it. I think she read it in manuscript form, and she finally said to me, she said, yeah, maybe it was a good idea that you became a writer. I was like 45 at that point.
I'm glad you told me you've been writing for a while. Do you remember the first piece of press, whether you were in fifth grade or college, that had people talking? You're like, oh man, they read my article. I know people read this because they're talking.
And I knew people were talking with an arc. I wrote sometimes some stuff in the Connecticut co when I went to Connecticut College. I remember writing sometimes for some of the publications. I think for most of your life as an author, you actually have the opposite sensation of being that you're not being read. And now maybe you are and you don't know. This was before social media, so nobody could tell you they hate you or they like you. So you're kind of, you don't, I'm being honest, you don't really know how to calibrate that. So I would say for most of my life, I wrote for very small publications. I did some newspaper story, some magazine stories when I lived in Mexico after I graduated from college. They were some of my first clips, but I have no idea if anyone read them. They paid me $1 for about $1 for each clip, just enough. In those days, I had to, that was before the internet, and I literally would type them up. I had a typewriter. I'd type up my stories. I lived about 2 hours outside Mexico City. I would get on a bus. I would have my copy typed out with markings, because I was a bad typer, but you can't, you could just fix it on a word processor, white out and all these things. And then I would go into the magazine. I would hand the copy to the editor, who I didn't really know, and they would sit there and they would read it while I sat there very uncomfortably. And if they liked it, they gave me about $1. I was always really excited because, I could go then see a movie maybe in Mexico City, and then I'd have just enough for the bus. But did anyone read it? I honestly have no idea. I suppose I really wasn't until later, where you're working for more major publications. So probably, when I was at the Hill newspaper, you had a skin small publication, but in Congress, if you wrote about a congressperson or a staff member, you had a sense that they read it. And you always know when they don't like it. I mean, that's always the bad thing. In fact, you're happier when you don't hear from anyone. It means everybody's happy.
So you wrote your career, you went for The Hill, The New Yorker, other publications, and then in 2009, your book drops, The Lost City of Z, one of my favorite books. I've always wanted to ask you, and we're going to do very short on each book till we get to the wager, but some personal questions. I'll use you as my thing. I've been bouncing stuff off. I've been wanting to ask you for a while. With so many explorers and expeditions throughout history, why Percy Fawcett? Why the Amazon? What drew you to there? Because you could have went to the Arctic or anywhere in the world. What brought you to the Amazon? I've always wanted to know that.
Yeah, it's a interesting one. So, there's a serendipity to finding stories, and you have a certain, you're kind of a professional snoop when you're an author, whether either for historical stories or when you're a reporter, you're always reading or eavesdropping or clipping or writing little thing. Now I email myself if I have a thought or I see something. Oh, this could be good. And there's a serendipity. So I'll tell you the origins of that story, which is kind of crazy. I was doing a story for The New Yorker on the world's greatest Sherlock Holmes scholar, who was found mysteriously garroted in his apartment. True story. And as part of the research, I was reading everything about Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock Holmes stories. And I was reading, he also wrote the novel The Lost World, and there was a footnote in like a biography, some boring text I was reading, and it said The Lost World was partly inspired by this explorer named Percy Harrison Fawcett, who disappeared in the Amazon. And I thought, God, I never even heard of that person. That's so strange. And it just so happened, it was very at the very moment the New Yorker was just experimenting with, I think it was called like ProQuest, or you could search old stories. And they said, we have this free kind of monthly thing, try it out, see what you think. And I thought, oh, this is a perfect thing. Like, who is this guy? Did anyone ever write about him? So I put his name into this search for historical stories. And I sort of got up came these banner headlines, including in the New York Times, British explorer heading into the Amazon, British explorer, last communication, British explorer missing now with his son, still waiting years later, wife searching, other people searching, actor goes to search for this British explorer and is never heard from again. I thought, this is so crazy. And so that was the impetus for this story. But usually with a story, you're kind of looking for something else. So you thought, well, this is a really fascinating story. Who was this person? Other people searched for them. And when I began, I was kind of thinking more about Fawcett and who he was and how he was kind of the last of these Victorian explorers and his attitudes and his what drove him and the mystery of what happened to him. But as I looked more into it, I became more interested in really about this ancient civilization, the city of Z, and could it really have existed? And I think whenever I choose a book, if you're going to take a reader on a journey, it has to be more than an adventure story. It has to be more than just, oh, wow, there's a human saga and this is fascinating. That's a huge part of it. But what is the story really about? And it raised all these interesting questions about what the Americas looked like before the arrival of Columbus, about attitudes, about racism, about how ancient civilizations, how the indigenous people of the Amazon were perceived. What was this natural environment really like? How did people adapt? So it had all these interesting philosophical questions. So you could tell this great narrative, but you could tease out these themes. And so it's that extra layer, and I never know where I'll go in a story. Like, honestly, I mean, I was always kind of interested in adventure stories when I was young. I read them, but I could have ended up anywhere, and I just kind of found this story. And when I find a story, and if it starts to have these rich themes, it is what leads me. I don't look at a
Oh.
place and say, oh, okay, I want to write about the Amazon. I'm going to read. No, I just was kind of like, oh, next thing I know, I'm telling my wife, I've got to go into the Amazon. And so she took one look at you. I mean, I don't know if you have camera for this, but
Of course, yeah, I'm looking at you.
I'm not much of an athlete, and you look very athletic. I do PT for my athleticism. I'm not an explorer, and I honestly am. It's kind of pathetic, but I actually hate to camp. I mean, I don't mind some adventure and stuff, but I actually hate to camp. I just don't like bugs, and I don't really want to lay out on the ground. I never really saw the purpose of it. I just don't get it. It's never appealed to me. And so, but the story was kind of pulling me in, and I said to my wife, I said, "Well, what are you going to do?" She said, "Well, I'm going to go hunt, try to go trace this explorer who disappeared." And then, well, what happened to him? Well, he disappeared. It's just like, I said, don't worry. I said, other people have gone. I said, there was another expedition, that about a decade or earlier that went and tried to do this. Said, oh, what happened to them? I said, well, they got kidnapped, but don't worry, sweetie. I'm good. I'm good. And of course I start to like pack, and my wife, who's the sensible one in the family, she's a journalist too, but her name is Kara, but she's the sane one. And a producer, and thank God I have her, to be honest with you. But she sees me packing, and I'm playing out the clothes. She says, "You went to the jungle. Like, what are you doing? You gotta like." So she sends me, and I never been to one of these stores. I think what REI is that? What, I
Yes,
think it's
okay.
REI. And she worked at CBS at the time, so there was an REI near her back then. I think it's no longer there. So you got to go to this store, because I had like a Swiss Army knife. That's all I was bringing, and I was wearing probably like loafers. I was gonna bring loafers into the jungle or some stupid idea, or like Keds, like stupid sneakers that look cool in Brooklyn and would like serve you no purpose in the jungle. And so I go to REI, and I start collecting all these things, and I'm like putting them in. I have this big card, and I'm like, my notion was like, Q in James Bond. Like, if there was some cool gadget, I just thought, well, that's really cool. So I was taking down the things that would explode and give you rainbow colors, and like, anything that looked just really cool. And I put it all in, and then some young guy who worked in the store came out to me, and I swear to God, he looked as if he had just come down from Mount Everest. Looked about 24. He was totally fit. And he looks at me and he says, "You've never camped before, have you?" And I said, "Well, you don't know what." I said, "Not really." So where are you going? I said, "I'm going to the Amazon." He starts
No.
taking everything out of my cart. He literally takes all my cool, James Bond stuff out, and he starts getting, "We're going to get you a mosquito net. We're going to get you some repellent. We're going to get you some, water-resistant boots and
Oh.
stuff." So in any case, so that was me as an explorer. But the point of that very long story is, it's the story that takes me, and so I never know where I'm going to go. I find the story, and it is the story that leads me and transports me to places and time and different universes, rather than the other way around.
When I love that you just told me that, because when you dissect every book like a detective, when you find the unpublished diaries and something like that, are you like, okay, now I have the book? Like that was like a huge part. Or could you have written it without it, but you're like, okay, I got it. It led me in this direction. Unpublished stuff like that, that's like the Holy Grail.
Yeah, that, to be honest, that's what made it a book.
Oh,
I
okay.
had originally set out, and I was like, okay, I was going to do this as a magazine piece. And I love my editors. They gave me an extra, I think I took an extra insurance policy in my life, and they gave me a sat phone. And I thought, they either hate me and they're trying to get rid of me, or they're just the most supportive people in the world. I still don't know to this day. But it was that extra piece. I remember going to Wales. I tracked down the granddaughter of Fawcett. And it really is a moment. You often forget what you write about, but that moment I still remember, and that was a long time ago. Now we're almost 2 decades ago. And I remember I was talking to her. I expressed my interest in her, in Fawcett and her grandfather, and she said, "Would you really want to know what happened to my grandfather?" I said, "Yeah, sure, if possible." So she led me into this back room, and it really was like out of a Victorian novel. There was an
Wow.
old chest. It was a chest. She opens this chest. I look inside. Inside are these old books. Their bindings are quite literally breaking apart. They have some of them have strings around them that hold them
Wow.
together. Some have little locks. They're kind of mud stained and water stained. I said, "What are those?" She said, "Well, those are my grandfather's secret diaries and log books, and they held just enormous clues to the mystery of who this guy was, who he was, why did he do this, and also to the possible location and the mystery of this place, that it could it really exist?" So that was such a pivotal moment. Of course, that was also the moment when I thought, well, because he had had his directions, he was always very secretive because he never wanted anyone to beat him to where he was going. And you could find the coordinates in these books. I thought, well, I think everybody went the wrong way, so why don't I go this way?
Wow. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, it was one of those moments. There are very few. I mean, much of research is tedious,
Yes, of course.
and you spend years often just looking at a magnifying glass at documents, trying to decode them and write them, and they could be very interesting, but it's very tedious. But every once in a while, you just have these wonderfully moments, and I think Eric Larson talks a lot about this kind of the serendipity of discovery, and there is that, and it usually punctuates these kind of long fallow periods, and then suddenly you find them. I'll tell you one other story about the
Yes.
last thing you see, which is on that expedition. There, what he when he disappeared, he went with his oldest son, and I used to often interrogate him, like, "Why'd you take your son on this trip?
Yeah.
He had no experience. It's suicidal mission." And I used to get almost angry, because you live with these people and you question them, but you can't talk to them. But there was a third person on this expedition that nobody ever writes about. The newspapers at the time barely paid any attention to, which is his oldest son, brought his best friend, who was kind of like a joker, who seemed like a really sweet guy who had no business being on this expedition. And I looked and looked, and I had somebody who helped me, who was like really good with genealogy. She was just wonderful, and she used to help me find these, and I would write letters everywhere, and I spent years trying to see if I could find any descendants, because I had letters from all of them,
Oh
but
man.
I had nothing from this guy Raleigh, and Raleigh Rimmel or Rimmel, I don't know, I think that's how you said it, and I couldn't find anything. And the book was basically done when this woman who was helping me with genealogy said, "I think this person in England might be a cousin of Raleigh's mother." And so I wrote, or I called, I guess I called. I found a number and I called. And I said, "Are you are you related to Raleigh?" And at that point, when she said yes, I almost just cried, because just it had been this kind of futile process. And she said, yes. And we had this lovely conversation. She had some memories to share. She knew his mother. She knew the family. And then I said at the very end, I said, by any chance, did Raleigh ever send any letters back home from the expedition? Because all the others did. They would give letters to these runners. These indigenous people would kind of carry these letters out. And then these letters would get transported and eventually reach England. And she said, oh, yeah, they're in my attic. And she had the letters, and she said, and I was able to, I had time, and I was able to work in his, his point of view. I had him, he was just kind of a cipher, and suddenly I had his voice, and it added so much to the story. But I was almost brought to tears in that discovery, because so many years had gone by, and the book's basically done. I mean, the book, I had a draft.
Wow, that is wild. I love having athletes on, David, and I asked them, where were you the moment you got drafted? Tell me about the draft call. The moment you became a writer, you became a New York Times bestselling author, where were you? How's that call happen? Like, were you out to dinner? Tell me about that call. Because that changes lives. That changes lives.
It's funny. I don't remember that much in terms of who was around me, but I remember it's a Wednesday,
Okay.
and I still remember I got a call from my editor and publisher. He's been the editor and publisher of all my books, and I had never published a book, so I didn't really know the rituals. And I didn't even think about it because it's like a Wednesday and it's long before they let you know that the bestseller list actually is much earlier than it appears in print. So if you're just a
Right.
reader of the bestseller list, like I always, I just would look at it as a reader and be, oh, okay, who's, and you think it comes out much later. And so he called me on a Wednesday and it was, I think it was about 5 o'clock, and he said, I've got some news for you. And I said, oh, what's that? And he said, well, you are now a New York Times bestseller. So that was that moment. I do still remember that. I remember his excitement and my excitement. And I will say the thing, because you asked me that question early on, when did you notice people are reading you? And as a writer, you don't, now it's different because there's
Yeah.
social media. Now you're getting people are telling you you're the worst thing in the world, or they're posting reviews, or they whatever they tell you they like you too. So, but you actually have this much. But back then you really didn't. I mean, somebody might write a letter to your publication, but you really don't. A friend might say good piece, or a colleague. But it was a much more insular process. And you worry with a book even more than a magazine article because you spend so long on these things. You spend years. That they're just going to disappear after all that, and to be off, and that often happens. And there's an element of luck and fortuity for why does a book hit and why do people. But that was probably the first time I said, "Oh my God, like this book's not going to just go into a, a little stream where my wife is just going to keep ordering from Amazon."
Oh.
Make me feel better, or going to the local bookstore and like just coming home with boxes. So I, you know, and say, you know, so I, so when the publisher calls me, oh yeah, your book is selling. It all seems to be selling though in this one little geographic locale.
Now you go from that, and I'm not skipping books, but the next book I read was Killers of the Flower Moon, which just that blew up beyond belief. How do you go from the Amazon? Again, this is me a generic question, which I do apologize, but how do you go from the Amazon to Oklahoma, a different time frame, a whole different book? Like, was that in your mind? Like, let me write about the Osage. Like, I'm always curious with writers how they jump from genre to time. Maybe your background as a reporter, does that help? Like, you'll write about Rickey Henderson and then something else. Like, is that how it was done?
Yeah, you are always looking. And I do think the hardest thing, especially with a book, is finding your next project. And it's the part where I'm actually least happy,
Okay.
is when you're kind of in that period, you've spent years with something, it's been an obsession, and then it comes out. And then, I do know some authors who are always like, they're all keyed up and ready to go. They're like, they've got the next one, they've got the. They just, it's like boom, like the lotto ball comes out and they're ready to go. Okay. And I'm not, I tend to be so mono obsessed in my projects that I really lose track of things. And I'm not good about thinking about something else. I really am not. I'm just desperately always racing, always behind, always searching, always researching the current project, everything I can. And so some other project, it almost doesn't have space in my brain for it. And so you finish and you're just kind of looking and you're looking around, and you know, several months would go by and you're reading and you're clipping articles and you're reading books. And I remember I do this thing where I call people. I would just kind of randomly call people. If I heard you were in an interesting job, or I read somewhere, I was like, oh, that scientist is doing some interesting thing. I will just suddenly, I'll go, you know, see if I can find a number, and I call you, and it's, my name's David. And those days, no one would have heard of me. You know, they'd just be like, and you know, off. Sometimes they're really nice. Sometimes they're like, I've got, like, I'm saving the world right now. I'm like coming up with a vaccine. Could you leave me alone? But sometimes they have these one, and I don't really have a particular question. I just say, you know, I look for books, I look for stories, and you've got such an interesting life, and you know, I just thought I'd just have a general conversation with you about what you do and your thoughts, and every once in a while that leads to me. So I remember I learned that the FBI had an internal historian, a guy named John Fox. I thought, that's so odd. There's an internal historian at them. So I called him, and I just had a random conversation with him, and we mostly talked about COINTELPRO, which was in the 1970s, was kind of FBI illegal surveillance. And then at one point he mentioned, oh, you know, there's this whole case, I don't know too much about it, but with the Osage back in the 20s. Oh, okay. And I actually spent several months looking into COINTELPRO because that's pretty much what we talked about. And then I thought, oh, there's so many books about this. There's not something for me to do. There's no space for me here to kind of come. And I looked at the very bottom and I saw some note Osage, and I thought, oh, this is weird. And then I couldn't find much about it. So I made this trip out to the Osage Nation. I went on my own dime. But I thought, this is interesting enough, but I can't really find anything. And I don't know if there's a book, but you know, maybe I could get a magazine story out of this. And so I paid on my own dime, and I did that thing that you do when you go to a place that you've never been. I had never been to a prairie before. First time I'd ever been to a prairie, and go out to Oklahoma. I went to the Osage Nation Museum because I just thought, oh, this is kind of interesting, the history and whatnot. And at that point, I really wasn't sure I was going to write about a book or anything, but I kind of wanted to visit the place, and I was just kind of interested. So I go to the museum, I'm looking at it, and there is this great photograph on the wall. And it was taken in 1924. And I was looking at it. First of all, it's a really big photograph. And I was just kept thinking, God, I didn't know you could take a photograph so panoramic back then. I mean, that's kind of what you're thinking. I'm giving you too much information.
No, this
But
is awesome. This is
this was
great.
my initial thought, like, wow, I didn't know you could do a kind of photograph like that. And it had members of the Osage Nation, and then it had these kind of prominent white settlers, businessmen and leaders, kind of all gathered together. It looked really innocent. You know, you're just kind of looking at it. And there was a part to the very left that was missing. It was kind of cut off. And I was meeting the museum director then for the first time, as she's since become a good friend, Catherine Redcorn. And I said to Catherine, I said, you know, what happened to that photograph? And it was a little like that moment, you know, with the chest in Wales. I said to her, you know, what happened to that photograph? And she said, oh, you know, it contained this figure so frightening, you know, we at the museum, we decided to remove it. And then she pointed to the missing panel and she said, you know, the devil was standing right there. And that is that moment where you're just
That's
like,
chilling, you know?
yeah, no, you just rattled, like you something rattles inside you, and you're just like, whoa. And then she went down into the base and she brings up an image of the missing panel, who is one of the killers of the members of the Osage at that time. And I just was really haunted by that. And it's really one of the rare instances where normally I kind of have an idea and I play with it, I think about it, I'm not sure. Months will go by before I commit to something, where I just said, if I can tell this story, if it's possible, if the records are there and the people will talk to me and they can share this story, I want to try to tell the story. And it was also a rare moment. You know, books don't usually have such origin stories. They're usually a little more kind of fuzzy the way they come
Yeah.
about. And but it was also kind of a weird kind of metaphorical moment too, because I just kept thinking, all right, the Osage removed the photograph not to forget what had happened. And yet here was this, what was one of the most sinister crimes in American history that took place less than a century ago. And most of us outside of the Osage Nation have never heard of it. We've never been taught it. You know, we basically excised it from our consciousness. And even when I was in Oklahoma over 5 years researching that book, when I would leave the Osage Nation, most people were unaware of what had happened, you know, 30 miles away.
How did you get them to open up to you? White dude writing about it. And let's listen, we're honest. You know, we write the history. We took the land. We make it, oh, we did this. We put them on nice reservations. We took care of them. How do you go in there? Your name's pretty heavy from the first book. Are you like, hey, I'm going to write a book, but I got your back. I want to tell this tragedy. How'd you get them to trust you and open up?
People have asked me that before, and I don't always, I don't know if I fully know the answer because it's not something you really ever ask people when you speak to them. So, and I'm always a bit hesitant to speak for others, but I'll give you I think a few general impressions, which is you go in and and I do this with all my stories. I just admit I'm an ignoramus, which I really am. I don't know anything about this. I mean, they're looking at this bald, nerdy, half-blind guy, from New York who's never seen a prairie. And he's suddenly out there, and you spend time, and you get to know people. And I would go out at least twice a year, and I would rent a boarding room in a boarding house. I had a little room I would rent, and I would stay for a month each time. And I would, Catherine became one of my first early contacts, and she would then introduce me to somebody else. Her brother Charles Redcorn, who was a writer who has since passed away, became kind of my amazing guide, and just so patiently explained to me Osage traditions and Osage culture. And I think that it's a process of reporting that I think applies to anything. But you try to have humility. You answer any questions they have. You explain how you're going to go over everything with them to make sure you get it right. You're not just going to, sensationalize stuff. You want to make sure, if you're describing something, you describe it accurately. But I think to answer your question, and I think this is a big part of it because some of them certainly suggested that to me, that I think there was a sense, especially among the older generation, many of whom have since even passed away since the book came away, that this is history that should be known. And so I think they felt they wanted to get it out. And I was sometimes surprised where when the book came out and the Osage elders had shared with me so much of their family history, some of the kids or the grandkids would say to me, how'd you get them to talk about that? And I think that in some ways it might have been easier for some of them because the history was so traumatic to share it with somebody who was neutral, or distant or removed to some degree. But those are some suppositions, I'd rather Catherine answer that question.
Incredible answer. I love how deep you're making it so easy for me. Like, I get to answer one question, and you give me like these incredible answers. It's so dope. Two last things with that book. One, I have a lot of authors on, true crime writers, and they'll invest 2 years into writing about John Wayne Gacy. He's a bad dude. The good guys got him. Here, it wasn't just a serial killer. It was the whole like community. It was the press, the doctors. Everyone was kind of evil. And this, why?
Yeah, people were in on it. I mean, that
Oh.
to me, that was, people would say, if you said to me, what was the part that most horrified me? And that is when I, and you always have to be open-minded when you do research. So when I began that research, I spent a year and a half researching a certain kind of book, a story. And it was a story that I thought was the kind of narrative that was kind of passed down from the FBI, which was that, this, because this was the case they investigated, and that there was this kind of singular evil figure who had committed these crimes along with a couple henchmen, and that they were kind of responsible for all this stuff. So I just kind of thought, well, okay, well, that's kind of if you read about it, and that was kind of if you read the court cases and who was prosecuted and who was caught, you think, oh, okay. And then, you start talking to people like Catherine, and Catherine says, I had a relative who died in very suspicious circumstances, and their money was stolen, and maybe you could look at that. And then I'm talking to somebody else, and I say, I've spent years looking into this one case that the Bureau of FBI never looked at. And then you go out to the archives, and you're looking through records, and I came across this one record, and it's a little bit hard to explain, but it was essentially a record about the guardianship system, which was this very racist system where white guardians were appointed to manage Osage fortunes. And I was looking at it just to see which guardian had managed a certain Osage's fortune. And this again is that serendipity that happens during research. I was trying to confirm a very simple fact. And I'm looking at this booklet and I noticed that a guardian had five Osages whose fortunes they had managed. And I noticed next to the first name the word dead. That was the only other thing written in this booklet, I should add, was that if an Osage had died, some anonymous bureaucrat had written the word dead next to the name.
Okay.
Then I noticed next to the next name dead, and the third name dead, the fourth of it. All five were dead. I thought, wow, that's kind of strange. And I begin to look more closely through the booklet. I see another guardian who had about a dozen Osages whose fortune they had managed, and there was about a 50% mortality rate, and on it went. And now, no doubt, some of these deaths were of natural causes, but it defied any natural death rate. I mean, the Osage had money, they had access to health, to medicine. And then in some of the cases, I could find traces, when I looked into them, evidence of complaints about a poisoning or the money being stolen. And so I realized that this little booklet really contained the hints of the systematic murder campaign. And so it was documents like that and records like that that actually demolished the book I thought I was writing. And at first, I will say, I was kind of like, I at first I was just kind of, I was almost panicked, to be honest, because you're
Yeah, we
thinking about,
overwhelmed, right?
you're just overwhelmed. Wait a second. And like, I've been working and outlining and thinking of this book, and this isn't the book. And this isn't a story about who did it. It's a story about who didn't do it. It's really about this culture of killing. And it's about this, you start to realize there are morticians who are covering up bullet wounds. I mean, some of the most sinister figures are these doctors who are administering
Yeah.
poisons. And then you have lawmen on the take, and you have all these others who are complicit. And when you read the documents and you get familiar with them, they refer to, they're all getting wealthy on what they refer to as the quote unquote Indian business. And
Oh.
so, I spent most of my life disproving conspiracies. I'm not a very conspiratorial person. Most people are just kind of incompetent. And like, usually when people think there's a conspiracy, nobody ever could coordinate very well. This is that rare case where there was a kind of a culture of complicity, and you do see that in societies. I mean, and to understand them, I'm always careful with historical analogies. Each situation is different, but I thought it was really important not to just understand that one kind of singular evil figure that the FBI had prosecuted and chased, but all these other people, seemingly ordinary people, who went along with this. Because you can't really understand that culture of killing without that. And the same way, if you're looking at Germany, you can't understand, the Holocaust if you just look at Goebbels. You have to look at the
Wow.
willing executioners. Who's opening the trains? Who's knowing but going home
Oof.
to their family? What's the reasoning? They might have a lot, they may be loving to their children, and yet they're going along with this system. And I think it's really important for us to try to understand that, because why do ordinary people do evil things? It's easier to understand a sociopath or a psychopath because they're abnormal and we can look at them as different. But what happens when a society does this? And I think that is the question that you have to kind of reckon with in Killers of the Flower Moon.
Time is our enemy right now. I want to obviously touch on The Wager because I always look at my favorite books of the year. That's when I reached out to you after every book, The Wager. I'm
We can
like,
go a
I'm,
little over too if you want to, feel
yeah,
free.
it's all on you. I appreciate that. When I wrote The Wager, I'm like, I will not take no. And I never asked Eric Larson to get a guest, but I was close to being like, yo, I need this guy on. You have to take me. Is it your thirst for knowledge? Are you a fan of the seas? Because it's hard for me to go Amazon, Oklahoma to 18th century British naval expedition and a crash in 1741. I hate to keep saying it. How do you even find that John Byron, a 16-year-old guy's journal, led to your book?
Yeah.
Like, how did this come about, David? I don't get
I mean,
it.
it is, I am a complete generalist, and
Okay.
I don't work, there are people who are just such good reporters and they do books, but they're covering Washington, Woodward's doing Washington, or people are covering terrorism, and I'm a generalist. I mean, like, I have this shallow knowledge about some very small subjects, but so I don't really know where I'll be. And I remember when I finished Killers of the Flower Moon, at a certain point, I was actually sitting in this room where we're talking now. And you're kind of doing that thing where you're like looking up at your ceiling and you're like waiting for this divine inspiration, and you're kind of reading the newspaper a little bit. And then weeks go by and you don't have a project. And I start to get that really uneasy, like, I mean, what am I going to do? I'm never going to find another project. And so on that one, I thought, well, like, okay, what subjects kind of interest me? So I thought, all right, well, Mutinies. I've always kind of been interested in mutinies. I've
Okay.
never written about mutinies. They're kind of an interesting, they're an interesting dynamic because I just, in literature and in film, they're an interesting dynamic because they are these, a form of disorder that takes place in a military organization whose very mission is order. So what causes disorder within such a apparatus? Is it extreme outlawry, or as it's sometimes depicted in film and literature, is there something rotten in the system that may justify it? So you see this play out in all. So oh, that's kind of interesting. And so I just started reading about mutinies, and then I was online searching about mutinies. And so you're just kind of scouring about, and somehow, and I don't even remember what got me there, but I ended up in a British archive. I think it's a British library. It had a digital scan of this 18th century journal. It was written by John Byron. He was the 16-year-old midshipman on the Wager. And then I'm kind of looking at it. And I will say, I'm a generalist, so I am not accustomed to reading 18th century literature that hasn't been modernized. And so, you've got these, the S is rendered as an F. So a ship, or whatever. You have these F's all over the place that are S's, and it's this kind of tangled Baroque prose. And you're kind of like, oh God, what am I reading? It was very faded too, but then you would suddenly come across these little phrases, and you'd be like, oh, he's describing this hurricane around Cape Horn. He used the phrase, I'll never forget. He used the phrase, perfect, the perfect hurricane. God, that's such a kind of modern phraseology. And then he starts describing scurvy, and then they get to the island, and there's the shipwreck, and they're castaways, and then there's this chaos, and then there's this titanic battle between these two figures on the island and the captain and who will be the commander, and then they get back to England, and they're summoned to this court martial, and you start to think, oh my God, this is like one of the craziest sagas I've ever heard. And then you do a little more research. And when I was reading it, I had no idea who John Byron is. So then you're doing a little more research, like, who is this John Byron guy? Like, who is this guy who wrote this book? And then you look it up and you start doing more research on John Byron. You're like, oh my God, this guy was the grandfather, the poet Lord Byron. So then you start reading the poetry of Lord Byron. You're like, oh my God, the poet is taking passages from this journal I just read and poeticizing them. So some of the greatest works of literature, have been infused and by this document I'm reading. And of course, like, nobody has really thought of this. And then you start to think, okay, well, could I even tell this story? And then you start to discover, well, when they got back to England, they're summoned to face this court martial. So they're all writing their stories, or they were keeping logbooks on the journal, and they're all having this battle. So, okay, you start to realize, are these written accounts? But then it's that final question, which we talked about on The Lost City of Z. Okay, this is a crazy adventure, but what is it really about? Is it about something larger that will resonate today? If I'm going to spend years on this and take a reader on this journey. And then, I would go to these British archives, and you start pulling these documents, these logbooks, and they come out covered in dust, and you look at a magnifying, you lay them out on pillows, and you're reading these logbooks. You're like, wow, this is amazing. But you start to hear them, like, they're complaining about misinformation, because what happens is when they're summoned back to England to face this court martial for the alleged crimes they committed on the island, they have to tell a convincing tale. And if they don't tell a convincing tale, after everything they've been through, I mean, some of them had been away from England for 6 years. Byron is 16
Nice.
when he leaves. He's 22 when he gets back. His sister doesn't even recognize him. And now they could be hanged after all of this. And so they're telling these tales. And then I would come home, and what would I do? I'd read the paper, and I'd be like, all right, fake news, alternative facts. And then I would go back to the journals, and I swear to God, one of the journals they referred to there is like, oh, that person's writing, that's a fake journal, that's not a real journal, that's a fake logbook. They used
Wow.
the word fake. And then I was come back on, I said, this is crazy. This is a war over the truth. And I thought, okay, here's this weird little story that nobody remembers of this crazy human saga that tells you so much about the human condition, about society. But it also is a weird parable for our modern times. I thought, okay, all right. And so that is how I got transported. I never thought I'd be in the 18th century. I knew nothing about British maritime life. Never expected to be on a ship. I spent a year just trying to learn the language so I could read these documents in the old English with their archaic symbols and codes. I have these wonderful British historians who have devoted their life to this, who are the true experts, who would patiently take my calls at all hours of the day. I'd be like, well, what does this DD mean? They in the muster books at the end of the day it says DD, and they would be like, David, they say it with a British accent, but I can't do a British accent. That means discharged dead. And so even that, I was like, discharged dead. And then I suddenly realized that these, you know, I suddenly saw DD after all the names. I realized, oh my God, these muster books are telling me the horrific toll. And I actually did these calculations. I would count up all the DDs, and you know, about 2,000 people went on this expedition, and like, I can't remember the figure now, but I think it's about 1,400 perished. They were
That book,
discharged.
I always love the ending of that book, and I'm trying not to give too much of each book you write, even though everyone reads your books to begin with, even though you don't believe it or know it. When it was just like one by one, like you think the book might be over, and then here's another guy who comes up. It was like the battle royal, old school, like wrestling, the Royal Rumble. Like one would come down after another. It was like, and here comes someone else. I would be all hyped up. It was great.
It was a little like you. That is where truth really is stranger than fiction. Like it was like some, you know, you're like, you just suddenly like, you know, up washes on a little ship like six years later. Oh, here's Joe is back, and Joe has a totally different story to tell, and he really wants to tell his story. And you know, those people aren't heroes; they're mutineers. And it just kept going on. Like you'd be like, and wait. Two more people have suddenly emerged, and it really is. I mean, you develop a kind of dark sense of humor when you work on these projects, and so you know, even I, you're kind of like laughing. You're like, I can't believe, like, oh my gosh! And because the truth is, when I'm researching these stories, and the way I try to present them to the reader is the same sense of surprise and wonder that I have researching them, because it's all new to me. Just as it's new, by the time I'm done, it's not new to me, but I want to write it with the same freshness, because to me, I had the same reaction as you did. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. I mean, I go to my wife, like, you're not gonna believe this. Guess who else just showed up?
And you know what? Not to get into it with the book, like I said, time's the enemy. Like a random, you know, maybe a few paragraphs, you talked about the Catasquan. I forgot the name of the random tribe that was going to help them. They had fires on the canoe. Like then you're invested into them. Like reading the book, I remember because I know nothing about the sea or maritime. I was so invested in all these random things. I'm making notes to go look up after. So it was just such a great book. I loved it.
I appreciate it. Yeah, no, and then you go down these incredible rabbit holes, and that's what it's like as a researcher. I mean, I remember when I started to research in one of the journals that the Carasquar, these indigenous Patagonians, had showed up on the island, and I began to research these people, and they had lived in the region for thousands of years, and they had adapted to those incredibly harsh conditions that the castaways were, you know, not used to. So they would keep these fires going in their canoes. They would travel in these kind of families. They knew where to find marine resources. The women would do this diving, and they could dive down and get these sea urchins through the cold and depth. And of course, they offered a lifeline to the castaways, and then the castaways are descending into a Hobbesian state and mistreat them and have prejudice. And at a certain point, the Carasquar are kind of like, yeah, we're out of here.
Yeah,
But
see
then
ya.
you find this detail, you realize that, like, this is where, you know, history is just filled with wonder. So when NASA was thinking of putting people into space, they were like, okay, how do we study people who have acclimated themselves to really difficult? And one of the groups of people they studied were the Carasquar.
You invest years of your life. Like when I have authors on who write these type of books, years of your life in it. So two-part question. Number one is a serious one. You're still doing speaking engagements. You're still on tour. I think you're going to Philly soon. You're going all over. This was done years ago. Are you ever nervous? Like, holy crap, this person's going to ask me a random question. They might have read the book last week. I haven't invested. Do you ever get nervous about it? Like, oh crap, I hope I don't forget some of the stuff.
Oh
Because
no,
years ago.
I completely. I'm being honest. If you went down in depth on like the Lost City of Z, I will not have remembered. Like my head, it's funny. My memory, I am like. It's like it becomes this. It's like a cluttered room, and so what happened? And in fact, my office becomes a cluttered room. It kind of mirrors my brain. So when I work on a project, things just start filling up. I mean, this room is just slowly starting to fill up with a new project, and by the end, the whole room will be filled up. And that's like my house. And then I finish a project, And I finally clean my room because for like 5 years, the room won't get cleaned. And it's my wife says it gives me one space in the house. And I try not to leave food around because the food will then, it will just be really smelly. So I do try to make sure that the plates aren't buried under the folders. But as the stuff goes out, it starts to kind of drain. And then the new stuff comes in and you're trying to hold so much of the new stuff. And so, yeah, no, there is no question. I mean, I remember somebody once said something to me about the thing in the book. I'm like, yeah. It's really interesting. They're like, I really like when you wrote about that. I say, oh,
Thank
good.
you.
I don't really remember that, but good. I'm glad that resonated. And so sometimes a fresh reader will know more about some old book than I will, or some old story. So yes, I try to hang on to them. And some of the, more crystalline, the stories that really stay with you. But inevitably, what happened in 1925 on January 2nd when the rain was coming down? So I would have known, perfectly and which way the wind was blowing, and it's gone.
On another note, same thing, 5 years of your life, investing everything. And then Leo and Martin, I know that's how you talk to them. You're cool in the Hollywood scene now. When they write a movie, when they do the movie and you're watching it, are you like, oh no, I tried so hard to get every fact, every spelling. I learned maritime language. And you think, do you ever think like, crap? Well, you just know it's Hollywood, so you're like, whatever, bro.
Yeah, it's interesting. Everyone has different approaches with this, with writers who have their work adapted. And I have kind of come for, my thought process, and especially having watched some people do this, was first with some of my stories and now with the books, is it's just a really different medium. And so I do not expect it to be the same, nor do I necessarily even want it to be the same. My medium is documents or interviews. It's a two-dimensional, often because I'm doing history. So the people I'm writing about aren't alive usually. And you're trying to bring them to life. And suddenly, in a movie, you will have actors embodying the people you wrote about. I mean, it's three-dimensional. They're blinking their eyes. Like, I don't know how these people blinked. They're expressing, their eyes are communicating to you. I mean, that's what makes acting so powerful. It's not what's always spoken, it's just their expressions. And I don't know often what their expressions are because unless they described it in a book or I had a photograph of that moment, or maybe every once in a while, luckily, maybe you'll get some recording or you don't know. And there are places I can never go in a book. So, you're not going to have a lot of scenes in the bedroom usually because people aren't usually writing about their bedroom seats. So, and in a movie, you get bedroom seats. So it's a different medium. And so my theory or my general approach, or what I hope will happen, is that in their medium, they're going to be as fiercely committed to doing it well and to getting at the same truths, the same fundamental truths that you are, but you're going to come at it completely differently. My decisions, people say, why'd you make that decision in your book? Or why'd you decide? I said, well, I only have so many decisions. I mean, my material dictates my choices. How am I going to write? How am I going to structure a book? Well, it's determined by the material. It's not determined. I mean, I make choices within those limited constraints. So they're just two very different meanings. And I have to say, I've been pretty darn fortunate. When you have people like DiCaprio and Lily Gladstone and Martin Scorsese, and they're like, they want to make you work. Like, these people are so dedicated. They know their craft. I'm going to be the last person. Marty, I don't. That tracking spot. What are you doing with that? I don't know. I mean, I would come at it from the north, not the south. But no, I would never even do that. But and so I feel blessed. But that's kind of my what I expect because these aren't documentaries. If it's a documentary, it's a different thing. If someone comes to you and they say, I want to make a documentary, well, that's a totally different equation.
Are you ready to finish up with some quick hit questions?
All right, hit me.
You and I are at a bar in New York City. You want to impress everyone in the bar. No one cares that you're a New York Times bestselling author. Who's the coolest person in your phone that if you texted them, they would text you right back? No, you
Oh,
curse, bro. You're David Grant. You do whatever you want, man. You
fuck.
got a name drop here. You're four drinks in, you're four Manhattans in. Eric Lawson's like, bro, who's the coolest cat in your phone? Text them now. Who you text them?
Boy, that is a really hard one. I mean, there are a few actors
Okay,
in there,
you can name drop
which I'm not
one.
going to drop their name, that I think will maybe impress people. For me, I'm kind of a geek. It's probably like an author, it would probably be like Eric Larson. I'm still kind of a fanboy around certain writers.
Okay, fair.
Who I kind of worship. So if I had one of them, but they might, I don't know if that would have the same resonance. So I guess if I was trying to impress someone, I'd probably have to pull out some actor. But the truth about me is that cell phone that I would have would probably no longer work because, it's not like I'm in touch with them. It was like for a very brief period. So I had this for like, three periods. So, if I did it now, it would be, they would probably no longer work. So I'm evading your answer very
I get it.
skillfully.
And you did it very well.
I want to get a Nick in there. Can you get me a Nick? I mean, you know the sports people.
You
I'm
want
a
Charles? We'll get Charles Oakley.
get me. Are you kidding me?
He just
Just
did
don't
my
let
sh
him.
he just
Yeah,
did my
just don't
show.
let him.
We'll do a three-way with we'll do a show with Oakley.
Give me John Starks. Give me Oakley. I'll be over the moon. You kidding
I'll
me?
get you one. How about this? One sporting event in history you wish you can witness live. Front row, any sporting event in history, David Green gets a front row seat to. What sporting event are you attending?
Don't know. There's some of those ones, and probably because I read about them in the DeLillo novel, so they kind of come to you through literature, but. I mean, the Bobby Thompson home run. I mean, just,
Okay.
how could you not want to be there for that? I don't know, watching like Bart Starr, one of these old football players in the snow. I would have loved to seen like Campbell run,
Oh my God, yeah.
I mean, look, I was too little to see a Knick championship. Okay, let's be honest. I
Fair,
would have
let's
hoped
do
the
it.
Miracle Mets, when they won it, these things that I didn't have. But I've seen the Mets win a World Series, not
Yes.
in person, but I've lived through it, and so I've had that joy. I was too little to ever see the Knicks, so give me the Knicks. Let me go back and see like Bill Bradley doing a jump shot.
Very fair, very fair. How about favorite show to binge watch?
Oh gosh, oh God, I can't. Can I embarrass
Of
myself?
course.
This is gonna be this will this. I can't do that. I'll
You
embarrass
have
me.
to know. No, now you put it out there, Dave. You gotta put it out there. What is it?
I binge watch like the OC with my family. I found it incredibly binge worthy. So binge worthy, sorry. And then my kids, and they all just would make fun of me because I was remembering things like in the show. And I remember somebody once came up and, I have this persona that is completely fake because I remember I once let this out and now I've let it out in public. I've only let this out one other time and people were like, "What's the fucking?" They used to imagine I'm sitting like reading Tolstoy or something. I'm like, no, I was watching the OC.
They're not even to compare to that. So I have tattoos on my body. I'm the biggest sports guy in the world, NYPD detective in the intelligence bureau. So we're out one night with all my friends, and we're talking about sports and boxing and UFC. And my wife walks in, and she's like, "Oh my God, I don't believe you missed it." And my friends are like, "What?" And I'm like, "No, I'm trying to tell her no." And she's like, "No, Mike's obsessed with 90 Day Fiance, but I didn't want them to know. Like, they think I'm this cool dude." And I'm like, "Oh, we watched it once or twice, but meanwhile, I'm addicted to that show." All right.
Yeah, and I will say this, I am addicted to any detective show. So
Oh,
I am one
okay.
of those people like Law and Order will just, what's good is you can kind of, they've gone on for so many years and it's a little like my books. So you like 12 years of Law and Order and then I no longer remember the first season. So I just go right back around.
Right, two more now. What are you reading right now? Are you reading a book for fun? Because I always feel bad for authors when I have them on. And what are you reading? They're like, research. I'm like, well, how about for fun? They're like, I'm just researching, bro.
So I am reading a lot of research now.
Okay.
I'm doing some stuff on espionage, so some of the books
Oh,
are more
okay.
fun. And so I've been reading Le Carré, which has just been fantastic.
Of
I
course.
reread The Spy Who Came In From the Cold and Tinker Tailor, whatever the rest of that name is. I read that recently. I mean, they were so wonderful. My daughter was just in a play, The Great Gatsby.
Oh,
And so
wow, okay.
I'm a big rereader. I'm so far behind in new books because I'm always rereading old books. I'm really like I'm a terrible rereader. I mean, I will reread certain books like I've read them many times, and I'll often read a new book that everyone's talking about like 10 years later. Like I'll read like Gone Girl 10 years later at the beach. Like no one's reading Gone Girl anymore. But in any case, so but I've said, well, I hadn't read The Great Gatsby in a long time, so I reread The Great Gatsby, and I will just say that book holds up so perfectly. And you think, okay, it's going to be this stuffy, it's this classic. It's not. It's the most riveting, perfectly plotted novel. It's sleek, it's thin, You read it quickly. And we're talking about themes that resonate. So I was kind of reading that book and I'm thinking, okay, this is the 1920s and stuff. It's basically about people, kind of spoiled rich people who break a lot of shit and then expect other people to clean it up. But I'm like, okay, it still completely
It's
resonates.
still relevant.
Human nature does not change. And so what a, that was a great book. And then I will say I also do Audible books for fun
Okay.
because I like to walk a lot. And that's kind of
Me too. Yeah.
my peace of mind. I walk a ton. I walk for a couple hours.
Me
And
too. Oh, I
so,
love it.
yeah. So I'm like, again, I love detective fiction. And so every like a new Michael Conley comes up, boom. It's like I pre-order them. They just go right in. So I just did the last Michael Conley. And I saw there was a Louise Penny. I love Louise Penny. It's not so new, but I haven't listened to that. So that's queued up next. So that'll be my next walk.
I love it. Now I'm gonna do one of. I'm gonna invite myself, and then I'm gonna invite you. So I'm actually trying to visit every country in the world. Okay, so I'm trying to go everywhere in the world, literally. I just got back from my 120th country. I'm leaving again next week. I know you went to Wager Island. So next trip you go on, I'm inviting myself, and I'll pay my way just to go to some new places with you. That's number one. And then number two is we'll do this live. We'll bring Eric Lawson, or we'll go out for a Knick game, and I'll bring Oakley because Oakley just came on maybe like a month ago. Behind me, even though I'm not a Met fan, Howard Johnson came on. So I'll get a cool sports guest
That
and
whole
we'll do
show.
a three-way podcast, a little round table. Me, you, whoever the guest is, and a couple of drinks. How's that sound?
Sounds fantastic. It sounds fantastic. So, where's the next place you're going to go?
I'm actually leaving next week. I'm going to Nauru, which is the least visited country in the world, the Marshall Islands, Kiribati, and Papua New Guinea.
For you.
Yeah,
Yeah,
four
I've
new ones. That'll get me to 124.
never been to that part of the world.
Yeah, it's disaster trying to get it together. So that's the next big one, and then that's it for a bit.
Have you done Patagonia yet? Have you done like that area, that region?
I just did Argentina, Brazil, but my wife wants to go down to Patagonia, so we have to do that.
It was pretty cool. I was actually being in a little wood-heated boat. I don't recommend that. Get a better boat than I had when I went to Wager Island. And I don't know if going to Wager Island is the ideal destination, but I will say Patagonia was it was unlike any other place I've been, and which is why I wanted to make the trip so I could understand it and describe it. And I actually am really glad. I would actually maybe go back. You'll never get me to go back humping through the Amazon.
Never. David, not that you need me for any of this, but just plug where anyone can follow you. I know you're not that active on Instagram, even though you got that unbelievable picture with Leonardo DiCaprio, Martin Scorsese. I'm like, that's the most badass picture you could ever have. Just give the plugs, obviously, your website and your amazing book, so wherever I can find your stuff.
DavidGrand.com if you want to read more about me, biography, and a little bit more about my books. I was a very active social media user, but I've kind of trying to research the new book and maintain some mental sanity. So, but you can find me at David Grand on Twitter, and also I'm on Blue Sky, is that how you pronounce it? Blue Sky, I don't know. Instagram, which I have an Instagram, and I do have a Facebook account. So I'm a little bit everywhere, a little bit on social media. I tend to share on social media if I have events. So if you want to kind of know where I'm going to be or if something's coming up, and yeah,
And you have events coming up. You're going to be in Philadelphia. You're going to be all over coming up, right?
I'm going to DC. I've got the paperback coming out, and I'm doing a kind of an East Coast. So I'm doing some Philly, some DC. So yeah, and then so it should be fun.
Listen, I have your phone number from the email. I'll throw you a text tomorrow to thank you. I'm going to put the episode out in a few weeks. David, this was so cool. Thank you for doing this. I'm sorry we went over, but
Don't worry
I
about
was dying to have you on, man. We're going to do it
was a
again
lot of
live
fun.
next
I'm
time, all
glad we
right?
finally made it happen. You're a good man.
David, have a good time, my friend.
You too.
Chat
Ciao.
soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.